In this lecture of Component 2, Unit 8, we will continue our discussion of privacy, confidentiality, and security. In particular, we will talk about tools for protecting health information. A good source to begin with is the Institute of Medicine, IOM, report that addressed issues of protecting electronic health information, entitled For the Record. It was commissioned by the National Library of Medicine and informed HIPAA legislation, and made recommendations on immediate and future best practices. Some of the content in the book is dated, but the framework is not, and gives us a good way of thinking about the problem. Some themes that the report covers are threats to security. There are insider threats, and these may be accidental disclosure, curiosity of individuals who worked in an institution, or insubordination, where a disgruntled or dissatisfied employee accesses information inappropriately. The latter is probably the major cause of security breaches. There are certainly secondary settings. There are also threats that come from outside the institution, such as the hacker who comes in over the internet. This type of threat to security has received a lot of press, but there are actually relatively few examples. It is really insider threats that have proven to be more problematic. There are a variety of technologies we can use to secure information. There are deterrents, which do not exclude people from breaching security, but give them pause for doing so, such as putting up alerts when, for example, an employee's medical record is about to be accessed. Another deterrent is the audit trail. There are system management precautions that can be taken. It turns out that a number of software systems do not protect information as well as they should, and there should be some kind of analysis of vulnerability. Here are some obstacles that we can put in the way of individuals getting to private information. 1. Authentication, such as having to use a password or other authentication. 2. Authorization, where individuals have to be authorized to look at certain information. 3. Integrity management. 4. Digital signatures requiring a password or other type of digital process to ensure that an individual who is entering data is truly that individual. 5. Encryption, which we will talk about in a moment. 6. Firewalls that keep systems inaccessible from, say, the internet. 7. Rights management, such as restricting who can look at what aspects of different records. Let's talk about encryption. One thing you can say about encryption is that it is necessary, but not sufficient, to ensure security. Encryption should be used for all communications over any kind of public network, such as the internet. Any medical communication, whether it is email or transmission of the medical record, should be encrypted over a public network, because almost anyone, if they have the know-how, can intercept that information. What actually is encryption? It is, in essence, when we scramble information using a key, and then we have to use that key to unscramble it. There are different types of encryption. So-called symmetric encryption is where you scramble and unscramble with the same key. Asymmetric encryption is sometimes called public key encryption, where there is a different key for scrambling than for unscrambling the information. There are a number of important standards related to encryption and other functions that are listed on this slide. Not that everyone in the informatics field needs to become an expert, but you should know what these standards are, as they are playing a role, and, for example, will be mandated in the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, HITECH, criteria for the meaningful use of electronic health records. First, there is the encryption standard itself, the Advanced Encryption Standard, or AES, that has been designated by the National Institute for Standards and Technology, or NIST, as the standard for robust enough encryption and decryption to be used in computer systems for securing information, such as health information. Of course, information is not just encrypted and decrypted on individual machines. It moves across networks, so the movement of data from point to point also requires a process that not only encrypts the data, but makes sure that it stays secure as it moves across those connections. The emerging standard now is the Transport Layer Security, or TLS, which succeeds a standard that was a very prominent route in the early days of the World Wide Web, the Secure Sockets Layer, or SSL. Of course, information moves according to a protocol, such as IP, so there is an Internet Protocol Security, or IPSec. This is part of the IP Internet Protocol communications process that was developed for the new version of IP version 6, but it has actually been pulled from that version and added to version 4, which is what most of us use when we connect to the Internet. In addition to making sure information is secure from one point to another across the network, we also have to be able to ensure the integrity of the information, that it has not been altered, either due to transmission errors or for malicious reasons where someone alters the information in transit. The Secure Hash Algorithms, or SHA, ensure the integrity of transmitted information documents. The original protocol was SHA, but it was found to have some security flaws, so SHA-2 has emerged now and is the more robust way of ensuring the integrity of transmitting information across networks. Wikipedia has a nice overview explanation of these standards, as does the NIST website listed on this slide. The For the Record report lists a number of best practices divided into organizational and technical practices. Organizational practices include confidentiality, security policies and committees, education and training programs, and the all-important sanctions, so that when an individual is caught breaching security, he or she faces appropriate penalties. Patients also need to be given access to the audit trail so they can see who has accessed their record and then determine whether it has been done appropriately. Some of the technical best practices are authenticating users, having audit trails, using various forms of physical security and disaster recovery, protecting remote access points, having discipline in terms of the software development, and ongoing system vulnerability assessment. The latter two are quite important in terms of maintaining vigilance about security. Now we will talk more about authentication and passwords. Authentication is the process of gaining access to a secure computer. Anytime you log onto a computer, you are authenticating. The usual approach for authentication is the password, which is a piece of information that you know. With more secure systems, organizations may require information about a physical characteristic or what you have, such as a biometric device that registers your thumbprint, or the use of a smart card or some other physical key that enables you to access the machine. In terms of passwords, the ideal password is one that you can remember but no one else can guess. As you probably know, this is easier said than done. We have a further problem in this day and age of the typical Internet user interacting with many different sites for which he or she must use a password. That is why, at least in busy healthcare settings, there is a goal of what is called single sign-on, so that you just have to authenticate once and then can get into every system from there. Of course, the downside to that is if someone else is able to get on through your sign-on, then they have access to everything that is covered by that single sign-on. There are a number of challenges with passwords. One approach that is commonly used is password aging, so the password expires after a certain time, usually something like 6 months, in which case the individual has to create a new password. A number of security experts have written about password aging, and the major conclusion has been that this is not a good approach to security, and it may induce counterproductive behaviors, such as writing passwords down, or somehow making them easier to guess. One report argues that other measures are more effective. Things like session locking that only allows one or a small number of simultaneous logons, so you cannot log on to many different places at the same time. There are also login failure lockouts. After a certain number of unsuccessful attempts, the individual is locked out. But clearly, passwords are going to be a continued issue in terms of keeping all our information secure, including health information. In the big picture of health information, security represents a trade-off. There is one end of the spectrum with no security where most websites will show you whatever page you want to look at, which is appropriate most of the time. On the other end of the spectrum, there is the level of security that is employed by some of the secretive government agencies, like the CIA or the National Security Administration, or NSA. Healthcare security cannot be at either of these extremes. It cannot be freely available to look at, but it also cannot achieve the kind of total security that the CIA or NSA can. One of the reasons why we cannot achieve that level of security is that you pay a price for it. You cannot, for example, bring an ordinary laptop into a CIA building. In healthcare settings, you can have many different people looking at information or needing to access it quickly so they can maintain the workflow and get their jobs done. So for health information security, there has to be some kind of happy medium where information is protected, but it is still easily accessible by those people for whom it is appropriate to look at. We need to have a culture of protecting information, but accessing that information by appropriate people cannot be too onerous. Before we move on to HIPAA, we will close our general conversation on privacy, security, and confidentiality with a few general issues to ponder. Who owns information? When a healthcare provider creates information, puts it on a computer system that they own, or for that matter, a piece of paper, who actually owns that information? Most would argue that the patient owns the information, although the medium is perhaps owned by others. When you start moving information across systems, ownership of the information starts to blur. How do we best implement informed consent so that people can really understand the issues and give truly informed consent? When does the public good exceed personal privacy? Should it be for public health measures, for medical research, for law enforcement? What conflicts are there with business interests when it comes to privacy and confidentiality? And finally, how do we let individuals opt out of different systems? Should we allow them to opt out of any specific piece of information? Or should we make it an all-or-nothing choice? If we allow people to choose different options, what are the costs of each? And is it appropriate for healthcare providers to override those choices when access to vital patient information is necessary to provide the best medical care and/or to advocate for the common good?